Penguin Random House Audio presents Guest House for Young Widows Among the Women of Isis by Azadeh Moaveni. Read for you by Sarah Arga. Prologue. Between Seasons. Spring 2007. Lucram, Tunis. Noor didn't consider herself a pearl without a shell, or a lollipop without a wrapper, or anything other than her 13-year-old self, wanting to practice her religion as best she could. She had listened to a sheikh on YouTube argue why the face veil was obligatory for Muslim women, and after listening a further 4 times, his words played like a ticker tape through her mind. The Quran commanded in the verse called Surah al-Nur, the light, that women not display their beauty and ornaments, except for that which is apparent. And is the face apparent? The sheikh argued. Is there anything less apparent than a face? It seemed to inexorably follow then that women wishing to submit to the divine will of God, to be eligible for his blessings, and be judged by him approvingly, should cover their faces. The sheikh's word made intuitive sense to Noor. Modest covering enrobed women in the core values of Islam itself, in peace, calm, and equality. It dimmed the visible differences between rich women and poor women, dark and fair, beautiful and plain. It was a reminder that God loved all his creations equally. Noor shared this new belief with her girlfriends one afternoon in the spring of 2007 as they were sitting in the park, Lucram's nominal neighbourhood green space, amid parched palm trees, heaps of garbage, and a decaying swing set covered in rust. The girls agreed it sounded persuasive, and one of them asked, "So, who's going first?" Most of them had started covering their hair when their bodies began filling out in the last few years, just a light scarf, and they had also begun praying, as many did in their families and in the neighbourhood. Wearing a hijab was ordinary. Even though Tunisia's laws banned the headscarves in schools, and you could get sent home for wearing one, it was still a commonplace enough infraction. The face veil, the niqab, was punchier, more assertive. But the sheikh on YouTube had said one shouldn't be timid about one's Islam, that even though wearing hijab was tough in so many places, the more we are in number, the stronger our message. Had Noor been born to an upper-middle-class family in La Marsa, a suburb of the city where liberal Tunisians lived amid Western expatriates and restaurants that served prosciutto and gin, she might have rebelled by piercing her tongue. But she was a daughter of Lucram, a working-class neighbourhood in a country where the state micro-policed people's piety, and putting on the niqab was a natural act of defiance for a teenage girl. That day in the park, as the sunlight caught the glinting sides of the juice packs in the trash heap, she felt a knot of purpose in her stomach. "I'll do it first," she said to her friends. "I'll do it tomorrow." She already had a niqab from the hijab shop near the pizzeria. She had bought it the previous week after watching videos of the sheikh. She had tried it on in the bathroom at home with the door locked, angling her body in different directions to see what it did to her eyes. The next morning, she stuffed it into her school bag and said goodbye to her mother as usual. As she neared the school, she slipped into a doorway and pinned the niqab. By itself, it was a small thing, just a little scrap of fabric that covered her nose and mouth to her headscarf. The fabric tickled her lips as she breathed against it. The principal often stood outside the main doors of the school in the morning, greeting pupils as they hurried up the steps. Noor fell in behind some older girls, hoping to pass by without notice, but the principal stopped her. "Who are you?" she asked, peering at the slim frame obscured by the folds of black. Noor heard, if it wasn't her imagination, a flicker of appreciation in the woman's voice. "I'm going to let you in," the principal said, "but you're going to have to deal with the teachers yourself." Noor's first class of the day was French, and she took her usual seat in the classroom, assembling her notebook and pens on the wooden desk. The teacher looked at her from across the classroom. She didn't say anything at first, just narrowed her eyes, then approached Noor, stopping to lean on an empty desk a couple of metres away. "What is this ridiculous thing you're wearing? Do you think God wants you to hang a curtain across your face? I hate God. God isn't some kind, benevolent power. He's cruel." The teacher crossed her arms over her chest, nostrils twitching. To Noor, the things the French teacher was saying were blasphemy. Noor stared ahead at the blackboard, focusing on the strange curve of the teacher's handwriting. "God killed my parents," the French teacher continued. "If I could take revenge against God, I would." The class watched the berating in unprecedented silence. The French teacher finally rose and started the lesson. Noor's next class was Arabic literature. In Tunisia, teaching of the humanities, especially literature, tended to draw Francophone secularists with a deep antipathy to the religious, whom they viewed as backward and uncultured. When the literature teacher saw Noor, she rose from her seat in surprise and walked over, blocking Noor from reaching her desk. "You're not sitting in my class with that thing on. Take it off immediately," she said. Noor's face went hot, and she refused. "I said, take it off," the teacher repeated, punctuating each syllable. Noor wondered if the teacher knew it was her. The literature teacher liked her. Would it matter? "No, I can't. Please, it's me. It's Noor." Her voice trembled. The teacher moved forward and placed a hand on Noor's chest. "Didn't you hear me? I told you to take it off!" She was shouting now, her face distorted and ugly with anger. Noor's heart roared in her ears. She stepped backward, away from the weight of the hand. Students gathered around them, trying to calm the teacher. She pushed them away and planted both of her hands on Noor's chest, shoving hard as if to topple her. Noor gasped and stumbled backward. The teacher's arm rose again, as if to strike her, as if to pull the niqab off. One of Noor's friends in the class, a tall girl who sometimes got called the giraffe, grabbed the teacher's hand. "Please, Ustaza, please, calm down." Noor was crying, glad only that no one could see the tears of humiliation under her niqab. By now the class was openly rioting. Someone had fetched the principal, who came running into the room and ordered the students into the schoolyard. Classes were cancelled for the rest of the day. In the mid-20th century and the decades that followed, men and women led the Middle East's armed opposition groups and insurgencies together. The women who took part often became international celebrities. The Algerian resistance fighter, Jamila Bouharid, who opposed French rule of her country in the 1950s, planted a bomb in an Algiers cafe that killed 3 people. A French colonial court sentenced her to death and she was tortured in prison. Her trial became an international cause célèbre, prompting a Moroccan princess, tens of British parliamentarians, and Bertrand Russell to plead her case to the President of France, who eventually stayed her execution. Bouharid later married her French defence attorney, who had fallen in love with her during her trial and became known as the Arab Joan of Arc. She was featured in The Battle of Algiers, along with 2 other films, posed for Picasso, and was sung about in Persian. When the Palestinian liberation fighter Leila Khaled hijacked an airplane in the summer of 1969, she inspired several rock songs, a character on the television show Doctor Who, a feature film, a mural in Belfast, and an art installation called The Icon, featuring 3,500 tubes of lipstick. She had to undergo 6 plastic surgeries to evade her own visibility. In this age, women like Khaled and Bouharid would certainly be called terrorists. But in the 1960s and 1970s, their popular appeal reflected a worldview that was more understanding of armed struggle. Such opposition in those years was seen as an expression of legitimate political aspirations, a symptom of asymmetrical conflict rather than evil ideology. Those decades leading up to and during the Cold War were dominated by post-colonial liberation movements that commanded sympathy.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?